Welcome to another in our series of Kehillat Israel podcasts. This is a recording of Rabbi Amy Bernstein's weekly Friday morning Torah study.
Very exciting morning, people. We're starting a new book of Torah. Always an exciting thing. So I want to spend a little time teeing us up because we are starting the book of Leviticus. We're starting the priestly material. So most people would say this is not the most exciting book of the Torah. Aviva Zornberg did every other book first right before touching Leviticus, which only came out, I think, last year for her. So I get it. I totally get it. But I do, for those of you who have learned with me before, this material, you kind of know what I'm going to say, but I'm going to say it anyway because we have some new folks. And because it's important to refresh our approach to Torah all the time. While the priestly material is probably the furthest from us in some ways, because it is about the laws of sacrifice and those, the technology for accessing a relationship with the divine that is probably the furthest from us in terms of Torah. And the people's relationship with the divine, right? A lot of the ethics we still draw from Exodus, from number, you know, there's places where even if the law isn't the same, we get the point of the law and we can bring it into our own conversation about how we apply that today. It's very hard to do that with sacrifice, unless you are a deeply spiritual person, as were, let's say, the Hasidic rabbis, who took all of it as metaphor. So if you take all of this material as metaphor, there's lots to do with it. Okay. So we don't have to do either of those. We don't have to say, well, I mean, they took it literally also that it once upon a time happened and it was a stage in Israel's development and God gives it to the people because they need it, because it's what they're used to. It's what they've seen. It's what all the neighboring peoples are doing. So it was understood that this was a beginning technology, but not supposed to be the end. So the rabbis say, of course, you know, it was meant to be that we moved to prayer. And we moved to meditation and we moved to song and we, right? So of course that was the normal progression, but we couldn't start there. So they even accepted that it was once upon a time tachlis. It was concrete, but they, to keep it meaningful and beautiful for them, really use a lot of this as metaphor. And I'm going to bring you some of that because that's how we can enrich our own relationship to this material. But I want to say that in the past several years, in doing research to prepare for y'all, I've come to appreciate that while the technology of sacrifice and of the stuff in Vayikra is the furthest in some ways from how we would relate to the spiritual technologies of Torah, its theology is the closest to us. So what do I mean by that?
Please explain.
Please explain. So in many parts of the Torah, we get a real anthropomorphic God. We get a God who gets angry. We get a God who rewards and punishes. That is the furthest from my theology it's possible to get. That God cares about what we do and then decides in everybody's situation what to do to reward or punish people. That is the furthest theology that you could have from mine and from most liberal Judaism. That is not Vayikra. That is not Leviticus. That is not the priestly Torah. There are other pieces of material in Leviticus that get added to Leviticus. We'll talk about them when we come to them. But most of the Levitical material is the priestly Torah. And having studied with Israel Knoll in Israel, having read his work to prepare for y'all, I really have come to a new understanding that the priestly Torah, the priestly theology is much, much closer to my theology, which is that God is a force that just is in the universe. This is not the technology I would use to access that force. Sacrifice, right? And some other things like that, offering incense, you know, whatever. However, there is nowhere in the priestly Torah where God is described as feeling, thinking, or acting. Nowhere in the priestly Torah. God does not have feelings. God does not think. God does not decide. God does not act. God is a force. And there are things that the priestly Torah assumes about that force that we might not, when we say the word God, meaning a force, right? We might disagree a little bit with the Parisi Torah, but it's much closer to my understanding that when we act in certain ways, we either amplify that, the presence of that force in this world, or we negate its ability to interact with us and with human society. Does that make sense? So if there's a force for justice out there in the universe, if the universe is put together in such a way, which is what I believe, the universe, like Kaplan believed, is put together in such a way that it consists of energies and forces that make for fill in the blank, forgiveness, for salvation, for redemption, for
curing,
for healing, for justice, for compassion. If that's how the universe is put together, the ways that we behave either amplify that and how it works in our society, or kind of shuts off the faucet, right? It's all of that is always trying to flow into us and into our behavior and into our human society. That is pretty close to my belief. And it's about how we behave that we either turn on or off the flow. We turn on or off the spigot. And so that is very much the priestly Torah. All of these laws, all of their obsession with purity and impurity is all about trying to maximize that force, which is only pure, that force being among the people because it was protective. And I believe that's true. We could figure out how to amplify, right, all of the energies and forces and whatever of goodness, compassion, equity, justice, transformation, patience, forgiveness. If we could do that, that is protective. We'll be a lot better to each other. And we'll behave in ways that don't weaken our society and leave it open to attack of all kinds, from without and certainly from within, right? Because in our own time, we've seen that. Okay. So I know it's odd, but does that make sense about the technologies as far as we can get from what we could relate to? But the theology is much closer than a God who parts seas and smites pharaohs and brings plagues and, right? That is not the priestly Torah. That is not the priestly understanding. And so if we can read some of this in that spirit, again, read beyond the technology to what is the theology? What are they trying to do and get at? What are their concerns? I think I share a lot of them. And we'll look at some of the ways that the Hasidic tradition and other parts of our spiritual tradition have used some of these metaphors really beautifully. All right. So we're going to look at Vayikra Aleph. We're going to look at Leviticus 1:1. And the first sentence is the sentence we're going to dig into after we read. Right. Hannah's already smiling, going, well, sure, of course, because that's such a rich verse. Yeah. Right. Of Torah. So that's the verse we're going to spend some time on. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on it now, but we get this kind of almost non sequitur. Vayikra el Moshe vayidaber Adonai elav me'ohel moed lemor. So we get this kind of sentence in the middle of sort of nowhere, comes this sentence. This sentence needs to tie the end of the book of Exodus to the beginning of the priestly material. Most scholars agree this is a gloss. This verse is a later gloss that is meant to connect the priestly material to the ending of the book of Exodus. You need some link between, right, the beginning of the priestly material. And this is the link. But there are problems with this verse. Mm-hmm. Vayikra, literally, and he called El Moshe, to Moshe. Vayidaber Adonai Elav, and Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh said to him, spoke to him from the Ohel Moed saying. All right, what's the problem? And he called to Moshe,
It's redundant. He called and then he spoke.
So what? So who?
Say both.
It should correct. It should say Vayikra Adonai El Moshe Lemor, and God spoke. God called to Moses, right? And you can even add spoke, but that you've got, and he called to Moshe, and God spoke to Moshe. Like that, it doesn't make any sense. Those first three words don't make any sense being there. And he called to Moshe, and it stops.
Unless Moshe was somewhere else.
Unless Moshe was somewhere else. And God spoke to Moshe from the Ohel Moed. That is not the usual way you line up the subject and object and verb in Hebrew. And every scholar knows that. No scholar disagrees that this is unusual. Everybody's going to argue about how unusual and what is the significance of it being unusual in this way. Okay, so that's what the scholars all argue about.
The word itself is unusual.
What? So it's unusual. It's not the norm. God doesn't usually call, right? God usually just, Vayidaber Adonai El Moshe. God says to Moshe. So getting a call is a little different. We don't always have that. So that makes it distinctive. And then the fact that what do you have of a verb? You have the object or the subject?
The object.
So who's doing the call? Usually you get who's doing the calling, right? Right after that word. Okay. So for all of those reasons, it's grammatically kind of out of the ordinary and doesn't really make a lot of Hebrew sense. Okay. To do it that way doesn't make Hebrew sense. Then we have, if you look in your book, that first word in Hebrew, again, you don't have to read Hebrew. You don't have to know Hebrew. Look at the first Hebrew word, verse one, the first word. And they should give you an indication that the aleph at the end of that word is different than normal. Do they?
Yeah, small.
Yes. Okay. So they have preserved for you in your printed version what happens in every Torah scroll. This is a scribal tradition. And I'm nerdy enough to tell you it's not in the 10th century material that we found. It is by the 11th century. So it's an 11th century scribal tradition that this is a small aleph. So the rest of the whole parsha is written normal, except this one aleph that's really small. There are reams of commentary on why the small aleph. We've done it. We may do it again at some point. So God calls to Moshe from the tent of meeting, say, now, what happened at the end of Exodus? Right? That's kind of good to know. What happened? What is going on with this verse that connects this to the end of the book of Exodus? What does it say? V'loyachol Moshe lavo el Ohel Moed. Moshe was not able to enter the Ohel Moed. Ki shachan alav he'anan. Because the cloud was shekening on it, right? Was dwelling alav on it. Uchvod Adonai, and the glory, the presence, the whatever of God, malei et ha-mishkan, filled the mishkan. How does that help us? How does that help us explain this verse, the first verse of Leviticus?
God was residing in the tent of meeting.
Okay, so how does that help explain the first verse of Leviticus?
Well, because he had to call Moshe, who wasn't there.
But Moshe could not enter the tent of meeting. Now explain to me the first verse of Vayikra.
He was outside.
Moshe had to be given permission. God's giving Moshe permission. Moshe can't go in the tent because God's kavod is in the tent. What happens if you walk into a nuclear power plant?
Bad stuff.
This is the priestly Torah. It's filled with the supernova that is God's presence. Moshe can't go in. So the rabbis tell us that's why we get the first verse of Leviticus saying, Vayikra and Moshe v'yedaber. God speaks to Moshe from the Ohel Moed. It's okay. Come on in. It's okay. You're going to be all right. Okay. So this is, there's a lot of opinion that says, yes, that for many of the rabbis, Vayikra, the call is a sign of affection. It's a loving call, because if you really care about somebody, you don't just, and we did this last year, I think, we did those texts. You don't just like talk to them. You don't just, like when I, sometimes when I come here, like, and I walk in and the staff are like ready to pounce, right? You know, it's like, so, but if you don't want to like jump on somebody and startle them, what do? You say, Harvey, you know, I've been thinking, right? You call their name, you say their name so that you kind of are asking in a sense permission to, it's polite and affectionate to get someone's attention before you just start talking at them. So for the rabbis, this is a loving call. Uh-huh.
If Moses needed permission to go in, why is God speaking to him from the tent, not in the tent?
What?
Moses needed permission to enter the reactor. God is not speaking to him in the reactor. God is speaking to him from the reactor.
We don't know that he's not in the reactor. What it says is God called to Moshe. God is speaking to Moshe. It's worried about where's God.
Okay.
God is in the Ohel Moed, right? So Moshe presumably is there if Moshe's hearing.
Right.
God. Okay. So it's worried about where's God, not where's
getting
Moshe.
On the preposition.
No worries. All right. So what does God say to Moshe? Daber b'nei Yisrael, speak to the people Israel, ve'amarta aleihem, and say to them, Adam ki yakriv mikem korban, when a person, I don't like this presents an offering, but okay. When a person makes an offering from y'all, a sacrifice to Yud Hey Vav Hey, from the cattle and the flocks or the herds, right? And they are picking their korban. Im ola korbano, if the korban, if the sacrifice is a holocaust, mina bakar, from the herd, you shall make it male, without blemish shall you offer it. At the opening of the Ohel Moed, the opening of the tent of meeting, you will offer it. Lirtsono, for God's favor. I mean, as a favorable offering. Lifnei Adonai, before Yudhei Vafei.
Can you explain verse 2?
Well,
at least the English says, when you present an offering of cattle, you shall choose the offering from the herd or the flock. Where else would you choose it from? What does it mean it's got to be yours?
It's either cattle or herd or flock, meaning it applies to all three categories. This is talking about a specific kind of sacrifice, the one that is from the cattle or the herd or the flock. So sheep or goat. Any one of those, these rules are going to apply.
Just back to your last point about the call. I'm still locked on page 1.
Uh-huh.
So the last way you pointed it out really locked in a little bit for me, and that is, like, if I were to call Susan, who's my neighbor, and say, stop on by, come to the door, and she comes in. And so
you like the rabbinic interpretation. Okay. Right? That God is being intimate and loving with Moshe, saying, hey, Maish.
I'm not going to talk to you.
Come in. Have a seat. Right? Right, come on. I want to talk a bit. Let's hang. All right. So why did I stop at presents an offering? Right. Okay. So the word for, and okay, bear with me. Those of you who know this, just bear with me. Korban, sacrifice, from the root kuf resh vet karov, which means what? Close. So yakriv is actually the verb form of karov, close. So it's actually, if you want to read it literally, right, tell the Israelites, when a person brings close from among y'all, a closifier for Yud Hey Vav Hey from the flocks, right? Because the noun is korban, from karov, close. We use sacrifice, but really it's like something that brings the worshiper closer to the divine and brings the divine, hopefully, closer to the offerer, that brings that force closer. That is what the sacrifice does. If you're near or far, what is that? It's a proximity increaser. Okay. So when you bring close your proximity closifier, right? That's what this sentence is saying.
Is that kind of like, a God manifests himself coming down as a cloud, and the korban is a cloud rising up to God.
Beautiful. 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 So God's manifestation, because again, in priestly Torah, this is just what happens. It's not that God manifests. It's more that here is God's kavod, right? Because it is attracted to the Mishkan. So we are drawing God's kavod here. And so God's kavod comes down and is manifested as a cloud. And now we're going to have a cloud of smoke go up. And also from the incense, we're going to have, right, cloud of smoke go up. So the two smokes, right, meeting.
Beautiful. And to mingle.
And to mingle, because that is the point. Intimacy is the point of all of this business. This is the technology of intimacy. How do we get close, right? So all of this English about when they present an offering, yeah, but in Hebrew, you can't miss that the verb for that is from karov, close. Okay. Because that's what all of this is trying to be about, right? So we know it has to be without blemish, a male. Why a male? It's practical. How, Harvey?
You don't need a lot of males to have a herd. You just need one hot male is all you need.
Right? So females are a lot more expensive, right? They are much more valuable in terms of.
It can be intimate, but not that intimate.
Right. Say what, Betsy?
And you don't want to waste them by breaking them up.
That's right. Okay. B'samachia do al rosh ha'olah v'nirtza l'chaper alav. So we're getting now all of the vocabulary of the priestly Torah, right? We're getting karov, korban, Yakriv, we're getting all this language of nearness and closeness. That's what the sacrificial system is about. And now we're getting words like lechaper to, what do we say in English? We tend to use the word atone, but atone is not great only because we so associate it with what?
Christianity.
Okay, that's not the first place I was going. Within Judy, but not wrong. But Yom Kippur and what? Atonement goes with what?
Sin.
So we don't always offer a sacrifice for sin. Yes, that's what this word is connected to. But we have so attached it to that we think of atonement as seeking forgiveness. Expiation is much more technical. Right? Like whatever sin causes, expiation is the opposite. It cancels it. So this is not about forgiveness for sin. This is about if I sin, I cause something to happen, something to manifest that is going to push against the force that is divinity, the force that is God. We don't want that. What do we want? Intimacy, closeness. So therefore, we have to do what's going to chaper, what is going to affect expiation for something that we've done. So it's very technical. And atonement for me feels much more like, right? It's all about us feeling bad and not right. And us do, you know, behaving and saying and weeping and wanting and, you know, and that is not this. This is straight on technology. This is science in this world. This is science. Okay?
You put a hyphen after the T in atonement, it becomes
atonement. Oh my God.
Which is a whole other
Oh my
God. No, but I mean, but that's what we're trying to do.
Yes.
We're trying to get back to a oneness or a shalom or a completeness with God.
Correct. I'm just going back to all of the readings in the 80s about that one. And I just can't. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, it is PTSD. It's a little bit of, you know,
does it have anything to do
with Mahzor or PTSD?
Mm-hmm. Time. In other words, we need come now. Don't linger. Come now.
Great. Do it now. You're supposed to do it as soon as you know you have screwed up. You're supposed to bring an offering. Don't let this dross linger. It just gets worse. So now we're getting this language of chaper, kapara, expiation. B'shachat et ben abakar lifnei Adonai, and you shall slaughter it before Yod Heh Vav Heh, right? And they shall closeify it. Who? B'nei Aharon, the sons of Aharon, HaKohanim, the priests. And the blood they will dash, they will throw on the altar, saviv, all around. Asher petach ohel moed, that's at the opening of the tent of meeting. Okay? So now we get again an understanding that the technology involves an ingredient that is blood. This is the science of Leviticus, that blood, the life force, cancels out the death force. And who's the wonderful rabbi teacher who writes about sin, that according to the priestly Torah, sin is understood to be death in life. Anytime we do something or experience something that is death in life, we need the life force to come in and lifeify everything, because we've got some death creeping in. And death is the opposite of life. And I think we even get that, right? If you've ever seen a corpse up close, I can tell you, it is very obvious. Death and life are completely, I'm not saying they're not bound up with each other, but it is the opposite. Seeing a corpse, it is the opposite when you're experiencing that than a live human being. Like the life, death, they are completely different things. So the priestly science is saying when you've got death coming into life, that's not how it's supposed to be. You need to rectify that with the life force, which is blood. Okay? And that is the technology that we're going to see through the rest of the book. So we're getting introduced to the scientific terms, or maybe Dr. Rajay over here would prefer the mathematical equations that make up reality, right? Like scientists tell us that mathematical equations are what is actually the universe. I don't get it. I'm still like, okay, who says 2 + 2 = 4? I don't understand. Somebody said it, we believe it, and now it's so. But they say to me, no, there's actually math that expresses exactly what reality is. Okay. So for those of y'all that works for, that's magic if you ask me. But okay. So this is the math of Leviticus, okay?
But the context of
here he had to
no, no, here it goes. No, I'm not going there. Okay. I'm not going where you fear I'm going. is this korban? You know, because people mess up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Individual people are messing up all the time, mm-hmm. right? You're not going to have thousands and thousands of people constantly bringing their cattle or sheep or whatever to the tent of meeting in order to do a korban. So if you have this ritual going on there, is this more for expiation of the people as opposed to expiation of individual sin?
Individuals bring sin offerings for mm-hmm. expiation. The expiation is about the space.
Oh,
thank you, because that's going to help me clarify. Remember I said the divine is drawn to the Kodesh Kedoshim. The divine is drawn to the ark, right? That's God's throne. God, right, comes down on the ark and fills the Mishkan. Okay. Or fills the Holy of Holies anyway. What else is drawn to that? What else is drawn to the sancta? The icky stuff. The icky stuff that we create when we mess up, or touch a dead body and so experience death in life, those situations are called impurity. That's called dysregularity. When there's dysregularity, like that stuff is drawn, impurity is drawn to the sancta as well. What is that going to do? That is going to, when you have batteries, the same
charge,
repel. That's going to repel purity, holiness. God is only holiness. So the icky stuff repels the divine force. So you have to deal with that. Expiation is about cleansing the space of the ickiness that humans create when they sin. Okay? Sacrifice is all about the space.
Is this the, does the Ola, the fact that it's an Ola offering, fit into this technology?
So, yeah. So an Ola is about what God gets, right? The Ola, the Holocaust, it is entirely burned up. And so God gets everything, which is different from other sacrifices where the priests and the offerer get to eat from it. All right. So for those who are glazing over, all right, let's go to our sheet. But we got to clarify our terms, right? Or else it just reads like blah, 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 blah. Right? If we understand it on its own terms, yeah. It is, for me, it's not boring. And people have heard me say this, who have learned with me, is that I wish we had more technology to help us access this theology, right? Like prayer, okay, right? Is it always the greatest technology? No,
it's
not.
Full sacrificial system just adapted from pagan.
Yes.
Ritual. So
yes. Yes.
It's just what was going on around them at the time.
Yes. This is the spiritual technology of the time and of this part of the world. The ancient Near East, sacrifice is universal in Mesopotamia, right? In the ancient Near East.
Even now.
In many places, even now. But yes, so this was the technology of the time. So, and the Israelites reconstructed it. So remember when I brought you that sheet that we talked about, the silent sanctuary? So go on. A Safaria, look up my sheet, The Silent Sanctuary, because Knoll makes the argument that one of the things that makes this technology in Leviticus distinct is that it is silent. That pagan sacrifice and cult practice that looks very much like this would have had incantations associated with it. And that one of the things that marks how the Israelites reconstructed sacrifice is that it is the Mishkan, the service in the Mishkan is completely silent. And in the temple. Now out on the steps, the Levites are doing the Psalms and doing whatever, and the people might be having their party and dance, like it's loud out there. But there are circles outward to popular culture worship, right? Popular worship. But in the inner sanctum, it is completely silent. And that distinguishes it from pagan sacrifice. You can buy that argument or not. I think it's compelling.
But they adopted the incense first.
100%. The technology is the same, but how they're using it. So it's very clear it's not magic, right? It's science. I'm serious. For the Israelites, they're saying this is not that hocus pocus magic that they do. This is actual science, right? We are just doing what we know draws the force or repels the force. That's why we don't speak. They're not petitioning. There's no God to petition in the priestly Torah. See, that's why I love this. There's no God who can answer because there's no God listening. God is a force, and you deal with the force the way you know through experimentation, the force behaves.
Israelites are being empiricists. They're being
empiricists. Whatever that may be. They're going with what has been proven in their experience to be true. Right?
2 + 2 = 4.
Yeah, 2 + 2 = 4, which I still think somebody made up. Okay. So, we're dealing with our first verse, right? Vayikra El Moshe, and it called to Moshe. And God said to Moshe, right, from the tent of meeting. All right, here's the Malbim. It is a syntactical rule in the holy language, the Lashon HaKodesh, that when two verbs come together to describe one action, the subject will always appear between the two verbs. Whenever the subject comes after the second verb, it is unusual and a scrambling of the language, such as here, where the language needs to be rearranged to explain that the noun, which appears after "and he spoke," is also of this, is the subject of "and he called," "the Lord called." I'm just giving you textual evidence that as early as our early commentaries, they understand that this is unusual, that this is scrambled, that you have to put Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh as the, what do we say, object, back onto the first word, "and it called," which that's not how it usually works. All right, so Malbim is saying this is scrambled. Abarbanel, 14 to 15, right, hundreds. The correct understanding is that the term "from the tent of meeting" connects to the phrase "he called Moshe." And so too, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh mentioned, they use "Lord" when we're looking at Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, mentioned here. And Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke to him is also connected with "he called." The meaning of the verse is then, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh called to Moses from the tent of meeting and spoke to him saying. So again, a bravanel has to move words in order to make it read and mean what we would usually think it's supposed to mean. So Reb Mechias Bar Eliyahu, 12th century Greece, the correct understanding is that the term "from the tent of meeting" connects to the phrase "he called to Moshe." And so too, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh mentioned here, "and God spoke to him," is also connected with "he called." The meaning of the verse is then, "the Lord called to Moses from the tent of meeting and spoke to him saying." So everybody gets it that you have to rearrange stuff to make this sentence make sense. So I'm getting this from Dr. Elaine Goodfriend, from her article on Torah.com. Rabbi Mechuyas's thinking is reflected in many translations. Like, so we just saw like all these people like working to work this verse out, which revised the order of the verse to have the subject as part of the first clause. Okay. So Bechor Shor, because the previous book ends with "the glory of the Eternal filled the tabernacle and Moses could not enter the tent of meeting," it was necessary for God to call him and give him permission to enter. We find the same thing on Mount Sinai when the cloud covered it. To, what's his chops? To Mark's point, we get Vayikra there too. God called to Moshe. So Bechor Shor says, we get Vayikra before God speaks to Moshe at Mount Sinai because God had descended on Mount Sinai. And so God has to give Moshe permission to come up to the mountain because otherwise Moshe could get, right? So, and that's why we have Vayikra here too, because God is filling the Mishkan, right? So because this is referring back to what happened before, the glory of the Eternal filling the tabernacle, it writes, "and it called," and doesn't write, "and the Eternal called," since it is referring to the glory mentioned above. So Bechor Shor adds something. Bechor Shor says, it's not Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. That's why it's not there. Vayikra, "and it called to Moshe." And then Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke to Moshe. What is Bechor Shor saying? There's something else. Lisa's looking a little scared. It's okay. It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. What called to Moshe if it wasn't Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh? You just said it. Yeah. What it? God's glory. Bechor Shor is pushing the limits here and saying God has different aspects. The cloud that is filling the Mishkan, because he's reading the last verse of Exodus, that kavod, that concentrated essence, that concentrated presence called to Moshe. Then the aspect of God that is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke to Moshe. So Moshe's experiencing different things here. Being called by the kavod and being spoken to by Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, which can be a very beautiful opening to, aren't there different ways we experience the divine in our lives? These are different experiences of relating to the divine. In one, it's God's concentrated essence calling out to Moshe. What is that? Like, if that's what Bechor Shor is saying, what is that calling? Like, what, you know, we could spend a long time thinking about what is that call? And then, and the commentaries do. And then it, then what does it mean that Yod Heh Vav Heh is the aspect that speaks to Moshe? So is Yod Heh Vav Heh the relational part of God? God who's ready to commit to a relationship, right? And not sitting around doing math all the time, right? Like, so it, are these the different aspects, right? That this is the Yod Heh Vav Heh is the God who is ready to be in contact differently.
From the promotion point of view, it's a form of consciousness. It'd be entered this energy that elevated his ability to hear the day above him. In the same way that the burning bush would.
Okay. But Bechor Shor is indicating the changes in God. Not the change, but there's different. Bechor Shor is saying there's a difference in the divine that is addressing Moshe. There are different modalities here. That's pretty pushing it. That's pretty out there. For somebody who's a pretty traditional commentator, right? Writing hundreds and hundreds of years ago. That, I think that's pretty out there.
But is to look at that metaphor in a more contemporary way, it's almost like the scene in The Wizard of Oz where they wake up in the field of poppies and stuff. They finally wake up and they see this glowing, magnificent city of Oz that they are inexorably drawn to. Okay. So that's like the kavod, right? That they can't hear anything. They can't make any further progress until they make it to the kavod.
Beautiful. So in that sense, the kavod, the Oz, in a sense, is calling. The Vayikra is coming from the glowing city, but it's amorphous until they have to, They have to then check that out. They have to answer the call. And then they can hear something directed to them, right? By something more specific in that city that is going to give them more specific instructions.
I thought at the beginning of this lesson, you said that there was no anthropomorphic God in Vayikra. And yet there's all this speaking. So how do we understand the speaking?
So they don't spend a lot of time worrying about it, right? Somehow Moshe apprehends instruction. Right? They don't spend a lot of time talking about it.
He's probably a good listener.
He's a great listener. All right. Baruch Schwartz, professor of Hebrew Bible at Hebrew University, suggests that it was God's glory or presence in his translation, not Yod Heh Vav Heh, God's self, that calls Moses. This is connected to the P narrative at the end of Exodus, so it should be translated. And it, the presence of Yod Heh Vav Heh, called out to Moses after it filled the tabernacle. The presence called to Moshe from within. A distinction is made between the presence which called and God, God's self who spoke. And then what he's going to point out is that this is exactly what we see in Ezekiel. So I didn't bring you that proof text, but he looks at Ezekiel, and there is another place where it looks like something like this could be interpreted from that text. So Dr. Elaine Goodfriend, this is her article that this stuff comes from. Why is the Torah divided into five books? Which is an interesting question. I don't think I'd ever thought of that before. Why is the Torah five books? Right? We assume, well, because there were four and then they appended Deuteronomy. So that makes five. She has a different argument. She says that she thinks some of it may have to do with the fact that, you know, every Hebrew letter has a numerical value, right? Because before Roman numerals, how did you do numbers? You used letters, right? Just like we do. You know, you make a grocery list. A, get eggs. B, right? You know, get milk, right? So, you know, these are numbers. So the letter Hey is the letter for five, right? So the fifth letter of the Hebrew alphabet. I therefore suggest that in a religious system in which no image of the deity was permitted, the fiveness of the Torah functions as a subtle image for God's hand and thus represents God's presence. Similarly here, that the word was deliberately moved to be the subject of the second verb instead of the first, so that the name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh could be the fifth word in the sentence. Another possible example of connecting the number five with the tetragram, meaning the Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh name, can be seen if we count every eight letters from the first Yud of the verse. Look, and she's got the verse there in Hebrew. Count every eighth letter, and what do you get? Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh.
No gematria there.
Right? No patterning there. The author patterned God's name into the first verse of Leviticus because it is, after all, the central book of the Torah and serves as a compendium for many of its important laws. I tentatively suggest that the unusual syntax of Leviticus 1:1 reflects the author or editor's desire to add another level of significance to the initial verse of the book by artificially placing the name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh as the fifth word in the sentence, and by writing the verse so that it spelled out Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh in an eight-lettered sequence. But that's when you think you know Torah. Just when you think. So any of you think, oh, I know nothing. Well, guess what? Like, neither do I. Okay, so look at that. That is incredible. So, and to be fair to her article, if you want to check it out, there's the hyperlink right there in my sheet. If you want to check it out, she brings like a whole list of other places where Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is the fifth word, the most famous and favorite of which will be Bert Kleinman's. What do you think it is, Bert? What verse do you think I'm going to say has Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh as the fifth word?
I'd be after Re'ah HaKamoch.
Another favorite.
But it seemed to you, Ki Kadosh.
No.
Not that one. You were not that one.
Ma Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai.
It's the fifth.
Echad.
So,
why do we have to have Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh twice? She would argue, because you got to have Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh in that kind of an important verse. You got to have Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh where it belongs, the third word, but it also needs to be the fifth word in that sentence.
It's a little
I don't want to insult anybody, but some of those are the academics. You know, they spend a lot of time on it. All right.
But doesn't part of that come from the idea that there are God's secrets in the text?
Yes.
And that and that this kind of analysis is probing the much deeper meaning that's there.
Well, she is not a fundamentalist. She's a scholar. So she would say the author had intention, that this isn't just a tangled verse. The author had intention in creating this as the first line of the book of Leviticus. The author of that line was intentional in putting Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh fifth.
He doesn't deal with whether God was the author.
No. She believes people were the author because somebody wrote it and did that on purpose.
Good writer.
A good writer. A thoughtful writer.
Something? Five and eight happen to be the fifth and sixth Fibonacci numbers.
There you go. Exactly.
They're the fifth and sixth
Fibonacci
what?
Fibonacci numbers. Those are the numbers that often appear in like the spirals of leaves of going around a tree and pineapples, and it's like a growth thing. It's in the Da Vinci Code.
There's math everywhere. There is. Apparently. Okay.
Jewish.
So there you go. But not to poo-poo anything, right? If that's so, well, that's interesting. Isn't that interesting? That's interesting. Five and eight. And here we have five and eight. Okay, so maybe there's something to this math thing. Okay. All right. After working so hard to facilitate the building of the Mishkan, after enabling the construction of the sanctuary for God to dwell among God's people, all in complete accordance with God's wishes, Moshe could not find a way into it. That's how we leave Exodus. So crowded was it by the glory of God that there seemed to be no place for a human being to enter. Moshe was alienated from the very structure that he brought into being. The Torah suggests, as does the Talmud, that this invitation to intimacy came through a quiet voice. The word Vayikra is written with an unusually small aleph, known as the Aleph Ze'ira, the little aleph. To help Moshe traverse the difficult distance from Mibichutz, from outside, to me, bifnim, to inside, God whispered a nearly inaudible vowel, right? Aleph has no sound. Aleph has no sound. You have to put a vowel under an aleph to give it a sound.
First letter of the Ten Commandments.
Correct. God whispered a nearly inaudible vowel. lulling Moshe toward God, inviting him to connection, to a relationship grounded in the ultimate mysterious unity of God and humanity. The numerical value of Aleph, going back to numbers, is what?
One.
And so it seems that God's message of love was also a message of oneness. We belong in the inner sanctum, together with God, together with humanity. Sometimes all it takes to bring someone on the outside in is a quiet invitation that subtly affirms the little Aleph, the unity that binds us all. Well,
isn't the Aleph an inhalation? Isn't the Aleph an inhalation? Like if you're going, if it's in a word, it's sort of like, it's like almost, it's, you don't, it's not sounded, but it's like an inhalation.
It's a breath. The sound is the vowel. The sound is the breath.
Right.
As it moves out.
Right. So, so it's almost when you have a if you were having a conversation with somebody, you could sense that they're going to say something when they like take a breath before they start talking. That's like the little Aleph, isn't it?
I don't know. Aleph usually has a sound because it has a vowel. So you vocalize it. You just can't identify what the sound is if there's no vowel. That's why it's often thought of as the silent letter, right? The first letter of Revelation is the Aleph, and the rabbis of the Hasidic world read because the first thing is silence. To your point, there's silence precedes speech, right? So for them, all revelation is given in that Aleph, in silence, the Aleph of Anochi. And this is this, the little Aleph of the very quiet call, right? We don't need to be summoned with a trumpet all the time to move from out to feeling on the inside, to feel like you're at the margins, moving from that to feeling like you're on the inside. Sometimes the most effective call to make that shift possible, to make that invitation attractive enough for people to act on, is a very quiet, sincere invitation. Yeah. And any one of us sitting around this table, or many of us sitting around this table, got such a call, right? To come back in. Please come in. And we answered. Here we are. Okay. Michael Monk from the Wisdom of the Hebrew Bible, the call of the small Aleph. The small Aleph calls us to what? Tshuva. Return. In the phrase, Vayikra al Moshe, he called to Moshe, the subject is not specified. The subject is really the Aleph. Look at that. I love these plays on word. Don't read. It's the little Aleph that call. Rather, read. Who's calling? The Aleph, the chief of the world, who is denoted by the small Aleph. God makes God's self small, as it were, so that God's holiness can be found everywhere, even in the heart of the most wicked person. In everyone's heart, the divine spark flickers, always ready to blaze into a flame of repentance. Not every person responds to the call of the small Aleph, the godly spark within themselves, but whoever heeds the call and returns to God binds themselves to holiness, and God's influence on them steadily increases and becomes more obvious as the verse continues. And Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke to him. Thus, the small Aleph symbolizes God's accessibility to every Jew, no matter how low they may have fallen, and simultaneously to a person's duty to heed God's call to repentance. This is based on the Me'or Einayim, right? So also a beautiful thing that the little Aleph is within each of us, calling each of us to return, right? To hear, to the divine within. And the way we do that, the technology now for that is tshuva.
What's the difference between calling repentance and tshuva?
What?
Well, here this writer says to call to repentance. Isn't it more of a call to return to tshuva?
They're the same thing.
So they're using these words.
Yes. Honestly. Yes. Tshuva is return. That's why its base is shuv.
I'm asking, why is he called repentance? That
supposed
to be the same thing as return?
And yes. Shuvah is, the root of it is return. Shuv. Teshuvah, to return.
Right, I get
it. How do you affect shuv? How do you affect return? Through tshuva. Yes, that is rabbinic. That's how you return to the divine, is you clean stuff up. You ask forgiveness for the ways that you screwed up. That's return for the rabbis. So for the Me'or Einayim, yes, the way you return is through tshuva, always. That's why it's called the Baal Tshuva.
Yeah.
You're returning to observance.
Observance.
Through, it's Baal Tshuva, not a Baal Shu.
Yeah.
The Baal Tshuva. Because that's right, though, they're synonymous in that world.
Returning to the answer.
No. Returning to the divine, to relationship, to wholeness, whatever, right? But it seems to me there's a deeper lesson here, says Rabbi Roni Tabik. When God wants to speak to us, even today, it isn't a single process, right? Going back to the Bechor Shor, right, with these two kinds of callings, right, the call and then the speak. It isn't a single process where we hear words spoken from a divine mouth. First, there is a calling, a wake-up moment when we realize that we need to act. That is the Vayikra, the calling. The details come later. That is the Vayadaber, the speaking. Sometimes when the call comes, we don't even know that it's God calling. Or as the country song says, if my phone still ain't ringing, I assume it still ain't you. Right? We may not know that it's God calling. Maybe you see a homeless person on the street and feel you have to act, or see a news report about the climate crisis. Sometimes only in retrospect can we say that that was a divine call. The call comes first. God sometimes comes later, right? You know, this is one of my favorite interpretations of Moshe sees the back of God, right? Sometimes we only see God at all looking back. It is then our duty as Jews to be good listeners, right? Meaning once you're aware there's a call, we got to be good listeners to pay attention to what the world, what our hearts are telling us to do. We should attune ourselves to hear the call of the divine, the voice of God, telling us to act and make the world a better, kinder place. Shema Yisrael, funny that here it is. Hear, O Israel, is central to our prayer. May we be a people that is truly ready to hear and listen. Right? So Vayikra, of course, he says this is descriptive, not prescriptive. This is descriptive. We get a Vayikra. We get a call. And then we get Vayedaber. Then we get the content of what we're supposed to make of that, right? What we're supposed to do. Okay. This is a calling for what a person must do in his life. This is Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson. Every single hour, and I brought it partly because it's beautiful, partly because I think I personally tend to have a lot of judginess about these folks, right? Schneerson and his folks, you know? And so I think it's important as a corrective for me to do tshuva and to bring teaching that is beautiful, regardless of what I think about other elements and aspects of that camp.
Helps us be better listeners.
So that we can be good listeners. Thank you, Richard. This is a calling for what a person must do in their life. Every single hour and day, you are being called and told, get up. Be constantly on the move to improve yourself. This calling can be understood in two different ways. It is a challenge for a person already on a high level who is told he or she must constantly strive to reach even greater heights. And for a person who has sunk to the depths, it is a call of encouragement, telling them not to despair. Despite your present situation, you have the power within you to rise and go out from darkness to light. Right? So those of us who feel like we're in a great place and a high place, guess what? You ain't most, you know, like you still keep going, right? Just because you can smash the ball over the net at some people's feet doesn't mean you've mastered every pickleball skill. Okay. So, and for those who are sunk low, it is also to be a teaching saying you too have the divine spark within you. You don't get to give up just because you feel like I'm unworthy, right? Mm-mm. It's there in you too. Use it. Start moving.
Can I say something about the name Schneerson? Where I live, way out past Thousand Oaks, that's the name of our Chabad rabbi. And when we moved in, he came to the door because there was a mezuzah on the door. And he said, are there any children in this house? And our grandchildren were living with us. And he brought some challah. It was wedding night. And I said, yes, there's Johnny and Lily. And the next thing I knew, Johnny was taking Hebrew lessons from Chabad and had a bar mitzvah. Grew a lot. So And they are the sweetest people ever. Sorry if you don't agree with me. And we've had such good relationships with them, even though I'm here, you know, because here, because, right. But, always grateful. And my grandson can lead the Passover service.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Yep. They're very good at what they do.
Never would have happened.
They are very good at what they do. No one's going to argue that. I certainly wouldn't argue that. They are very good at what they do. All right. And we have a lot to learn from that model, right? About the hospitality, about.
The Rebbe would have loved you, Amy. The Rebbe would have loved you.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Oh, I'm sure. I'm
no.
Sure. All right. Being a Person by William Stafford. Be a person here. Stand by the river. Invoke the owls. Invoke winter, then spring. Let any season that wants to come here make its own call. After that sound goes away, wait. A slow bubble rises through the earth and begins to include sky, stars, all space, even the outracing, expanding thought. Come back and hear the little sound again. Suddenly, this dream you are having matches everyone's dream, and the result is the world. If a different call came, there wouldn't be any world, or you, or the river, or the owls calling. How you stand here is important. How you listen for the next things to happen. How you breathe.
You've been listening to Rabbi Amy Bernstein's Friday Morning Torah Study from Kehillat Israel in Pacific Palisades, California. For more information, go to our website, www.ourki.org.